You are listening to Help for HD Live, the first podcast created for families living with Huntington's and juvenile Huntington's disease. Don't forget to find us on iTunes, Blog Talk, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. You can also search over 500 archived episodes and other projects at helpforhd.org. To watch us in person, find Help for HD TV on YouTube and subscribe and ring the bell for notifications on new content. Help for HD Live is going on air in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in to Help for HD Live. This program is made possible because of Teva Pharmaceuticals and Neurocrine Biosciences. I'm your host, Lauren Holder, and today we have Jennifer Billet on with us, who is with Sage Therapeutics. She's an executive director and program lead for investigational SAGE-718 at Sage Therapeutics. She's responsible for driving the global development strategy, including delivery of the right evidence for key stakeholders, including regulators, payers, and providers, and patients. Dalzanemdor is being evaluated for indications in Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's, and cognitive impairment in Parkinson's. Jennifer has 20 years of deep expertise in the measurement science of clinical outcomes assessment and significant experience in all phases of drug development. Jennifer received her bachelor's in economics at Virginia Tech and her PhD from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. She has published and presented extensively on health economics and outcome research topics and clinical research across a range of leading journals and conferences. She's also just an amazing person. I've gotten the chance to just talk to her offline multiple times and truly amazing person. So Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for having me here. We really appreciate the invitation to join, and I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. So, you know, I've been wanting to do a podcast with you guys for a while. I did a podcast about kind of my experience in the trial with Sage, but I really wanted to have you guys on just so we could get some more background on SAGE-718. And as I keep telling people, the reason this is so important is because that this is the first treatment that's being studied in HD that focuses strictly on cognitive symptoms of HD, right? Like, that is huge that we're finally getting to a point of focusing on cognitive symptoms in HD, which I think has really just been put on the back burner for so long and now has become this big thing. So today, Jennifer and I are going to be talking about cognitive symptoms and why treating cognitive symptoms is important. Yeah. So let's just jump right in. Sage Therapeutics is conducting research through its Perspective clinical program on cognition in HD. So what is cognition? And if you can share just some examples of what cognitive processes are too.
Yeah, happy to. So as I mentioned, I'm program lead for SAGE-718. Dalzanemdor would be the way I say it. Then it has, you know, kind of a roll off the tongue feel. I joined the company back in 2018, and we've been working on cognitive impairment in Huntington's disease since even before then. So this has been quite a journey that I've been on with the company, but that the company has been on to focus in this area. To answer your question, cognition, you know, it's the set of skills that the brain uses to perceive, acquire, understand, respond to information. Clinically, cognition is defined with 6 distinct functional areas, though. So this would be executive functioning. And if you think of the executive level of a suite, this is your highest order of functioning, your operations, task switching, organization, planning, all of that stuff. Learning and memory is in there next. This is the ability to retain and apply new information. Language, social cognition, complex attention, and perceptual and motor function. So you can see this really impacts all aspects of daily life, from the ability to think cohesively, move freely, and interact socially. In a few words, cognition is the sum of all of our mental capacity. It gives us the ability to function, feel, think, and in many ways makes us who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And as most of the people in the HD community know, we know that we're suffering from these things, but I think that we don't usually know the terms, right? So
Yes.
executive function is a big topic right now. And the easiest way that I can think to explain to the community or to compare something would be attention deficit disorder. So when you think of cognitive impairment and that executive function issue, very similar to attention deficit disorder or ADD, ADHD. And that's kind of,
The
I did a
similar
video.
construct being impacted. Yes.
Right. I did a video trying to explain it because I think that we tend to not think about the actual terms and what cognitive processes are. So, I'm really glad that you listed what they actually are clinically, so that
It helps to
we
have
know that.
the right words, yeah, to use to describe how you're feeling.
Yeah. So, what about cognitive impairment? What is cognitive impairment? What it contributes to that in HD?
Well, in HD specifically, and first I'll start by saying, as you know, HD is a complex genetic condition. So there's a lot happening. And as a scientific community, we're still continuing to learn more, hour by hour, even on some days. And we could do an entire podcast on this alone, on this topic alone. But one area we've seen evidence in is this connection of the mutant Huntington gene and disruption of normal function of the NMDA receptor. And this can impact normal synaptic functioning. So I'm like getting stuck. These NMDA receptors play a key role in regulating brain function. And this includes cognition, executive functioning specifically. When there's a disruption in that functioning, in that connection, it can contribute to cognitive decline. So as things start to misfire and they're not working properly, it can feel like a light bulb that's operating at full luminary capacity, and it starts to dim and continues in the wrong direction. And so this association has really informed our research at Sage and our clinical program, which is the prospective program that's ongoing.
It's a perfect analogy. I just want to say, what a great way of explaining that. And yeah, that's what it feels like. So, wow. So we again going back to executive function. Obviously, everybody knows that that's my big passion right now, just because that's the main thing that I deal with. But we know that executive function is one of the first things affected in HD. But specifically, let's talk about executive function. What is it? What are some examples?
It's a key piece. Executive function is one of our overall cognitive abilities, and it plays a major role. It impacts everything we do. It helps us operate at our full capacity. But specifically, it informs our ability to plan, make decisions, organize, prioritize. So when we're working, this is our ability to sort through the prioritization of our tasks, that are in front of us. It helps us multitask, juggle new information, apply it, and then get back to the thing that we were originally working on, switching back and forth between two things, being engaged in a conversation and taking notes. That's executive functioning. We notice as things start to go wrong in executive functioning, particularly like HD, you're not able to juggle these things anymore. We heard stories from people with this experience that talked about the impact it had on cooking and the ability to chop a salad and cook the spaghetti at the same time. They were focused on chopping the salad and forgot that there was water on the stove and completely boiled over and made a mess. Or people who are talking and trying to cook dinner, which people do all the time, but you can't do it. You can't do it. Either you're losing track of the conversation, or in order to focus on the food, or you're completely oblivious to the food, and you're, really immersed in. And this is, it's an exaggeration of the little things that people notice without HD, but it's exaggerated when HD comes into play, and it just progresses. And so this is, an important piece of your high level functioning, and research has suggested that this starts to decline. This significant decline in executive functioning can be detected in the early stages of HD, even preclinically, before a motor diagnosis.
And those symptoms are so tough, right? Because they can affect work big time. You're talking about when you need to organize and you need to have tasks to complete, and you can't prioritize. Not only are you dealing with, okay, one, I can't multitask, so I can't focus on responding to this email and,
Working through this report, yeah.
can't do it. But then it's overwhelming, right? And then it's like, oh my God, I can't do this. And you shut down.
Yes,
And
yes.
it's just
And then it's
because,
hard to recover. Then you need to take a 2-hour break, go take a walk, and come back. It's
Or the other side of that is, okay, you push through, right? And you do it, but it takes so much more brain power and processing. It takes longer. And like by the time you're done and you finally get to that point, it's like I can't even process what I'm reading now. Like I can't do it.
You're working so hard to access your cognitive reserve, and where you have these habits already of being able to deliver, and you're trying to access that structure to stay as high functioning as you had always been.
And
Exhausting.
that's the thing too, like when you think about, okay, these are things that, okay, so I'll use myself as an example just because I'm dealing with it, but I was an executive assistant and an administrative assistant, multiple roles. I managed more than one calendar. I had at one point I was managing 11 different case managers, on top of also managing a database, and scheduling everything for them. And so it was nothing, right? Like I could multitask, get things done. It wasn't, I didn't even have to think about it.
In fact, it's
And
fun. You love taking it in
exactly.
and driving things, and yes, disseminating.
Planning events and, doing that. And I could do it all, plus do whatever. And now I can't. I literally, like, it doesn't seem like it would be a big deal, but I cannot sit here and do multiple things. I have to do one thing at a time because I cannot, it takes too much energy. It's crazy because when you have been a person who literally was able to do all of that and you didn't even think about it, and now you have to actually sit there and go, okay, what's my next step? And I'll stop myself and I do that. Even walking into the kitchen, I noticed this the other day. Walking into the kitchen, I walked in and I went, okay, what was I doing? Oh, got it. And I'm literally talking to myself and going, okay, what was my next step? Oh, refrigerator. So that's not, it's
Don't lose
not,
it. Don't lose it.
right. Not something that I'm used to, because I wasn't that way, But that is what executive function is. And I know there are people listening who go, oh, well, I have ADD or ADHD. So I deal with that anyway.
This is on another level.
It's on another level. That's right. But it is a way to compare and really understand that executive dysfunction there. And yes, people with ADHD and ADD have executive dysfunction. So it helps us to understand, oh, okay, well, this is real, this is a thing, and that's how you can really learn more information about it. But as Jennifer just said, it's on another level.
And it includes more constructs than just executive functioning. So the progression of HD does include the social construct, having a hard time interjecting into a group conversation or contributing in real time to a one-on-one conversation. These things start to be more difficult and use more energy. We also heard, that it was hard to learn something new at work. A new process or a new financial system. It was hard to understand what was being asked of them and then hold it and apply it. That the ability to retain new pathways or new information. We heard from somebody who actually was driving into work with their partner, and there was construction in their normal pathway to get to the parking garage. And she said, normally I would follow the signs for the construction detour, but now my brain can't sort out where we're going. And I have to let my husband drive when there's construction because my brain can't follow the new signs and adapt and be agile enough to take on entering the parking garage from the other side. It's too much for my brain to get around. And this is really disruptive, this robs people of independence. You're afraid to drive on your own because it's harder to sort out these new events that are coming at you and things that you're going to have to process in real time, real speed, and the nervousness with being able to tackle that. It's hard, and people start to pull back from things like that, because they don't want to be put in an unfortunate position.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's something that I've been dealing with recently, and that's the social anxiety side of things, where, as you mentioned, like it's harder to, if there's a change in anything, it's harder to deal with. But there's also this, it's like a sensory overload, right? Like too much input. And so when you have too much input, trying to process everything, it throws you off. And so then it's like, oh my God, I can't be right here. And there's this social anxiety of, oh, okay, there's too many people. Don't. So I notice, like, even going into the grocery store now, if I have to go in, which normally I just order groceries, but if I have to go in, I'm literally just
Tunnel vision.
tunnel vision, because otherwise I'm so overwhelmed. And by the time I get home, I'm like, I'm too tired to do anything else.
Oh, that's stressful.
It's crazy to think that that's just part of it. That's just part of cognitive function.
That we take for granted and is changing, for people with HD.
So let's get into why it's important to target the cognitive symptoms. Why is it so important that we deal with these cognitive symptoms in HD and really treat them?
Well, it's something that we're seeing being discussed more and more. Impaired cognition having a negative impact on daily functioning. This can, take people's independence much earlier than than it should be happening. And cognitive impairment is coming in before the motor symptoms are present. So, being able to raise awareness on this, and across the ecosystem of the Huntington's community, the role cognition plays, and that things are changing early for people who have Huntington's, and prioritize this in research so that we can measure what impairment looks like. Pull this into natural history studies and target this as a potential treatment benefit. As the HD condition progresses, cognition further deteriorates and overall functioning is impacted. This creates a burden for people living with Huntington's, the family community, and broadly. And so we heard in some patient interviews that cognitive impairment is impacting the ability to stay working, stay fully employed, even shifting to a different set of responsibilities or shifting to part-time work, it's still difficult to keep up. Running your home is becoming harder and harder. And as you already said, being social, even not intending to be social, but just going to the grocery store as a social engagement is challenging. And so we need to be able to track these things so that we can understand better what this looks like, further characterize it, further talk about it, so there can be social support for when this happens. There can be a discussion on, what this looks like in progression. And so for us, I think these, what we're seeing in the research side is that these symptoms also do have a knock-on effect on healthcare resource use. You're accessing your physician more to help you through this, increased costs. And this could often come at times when people are shifting their healthcare coverage from employer-based coverage to government-based coverage. And so then things are changing when you're trying to sort out your path forward in treatment or even just categorizing what's happening. Your access to certain specialists is changing over that transition. So it's we feel that it's time to move this into the front of the conversation and make sure that people are more aware of what this looks like.
That's awesome. Let's discuss patient-reported outcomes. So, what are they, and if anything, what has been reported?
Yeah, it's a good question. And disclaimer, my background is in patient-reported outcomes. So this is where I started 20 years ago as a research assistant. This is my favorite area to talk about. So stop me if I go off too long. But the official term for patient-reported outcomes, this is really specific to research. But coming from the FDA, the definition is the status of a patient's health condition coming directly from the patient without interpretation of their response by a clinician or anyone else. And this is really key in Huntington's. And when I started, at Sage and started working in the Huntington space, with the team, is that a lot of the measures in the Huntington space are clinician assessed. Or their care partner assessed, or they are performance-based measures. So measures that are, motor assessment or formal performance cognitive tests, the neuropsych testing, for instance. And so, a patient-reported outcome measure is something that you could engage with on the Enroll HD platform. It's something that you complete yourself. Without interpretation or adjustment. But there's not a lot of Huntington specific PROs. And the ones that are there, they're targeted more towards the later Huntington's experience, loss of daily functioning or loss of motor capacity or changes in behavior, all of which are very important, but are different from the very early changes that are happening in the executive functioning space. And so as we spoke with the patient community, we wanted to understand where were people coming from? What were they doing right now in terms of the earliest stages? Were people still working? Were they driving? What was going on? And so we conducted a bunch of interviews with people who had Huntington's and they brought in their care partners. So kind of paired interviews individually. And the conversations that we heard were really they were really enlightening, but they were really specific to the first person's experience. I noticed I was making mistakes in my deliverables. I noticed that I couldn't keep up with, I missed meetings. I when a change in my priority, came from a manager, I had to sit out for 2 hours, go take a walk, clear my head, and then return and be able to get back on task. I couldn't drive, through construction, and a lot of these experiences were firsthand. And then the conversations we heard from the care partners were, the second hand of what they, you know, they had been told. And it was, you know, she's really stressed out because she never used to make mistakes, and now she is. And so it was very interesting that the information we were hearing was really passionate from the person experiencing it, and very, very clearly described and very upsetting. And so we were thinking, you know, there might be a gap here in how this is being assessed. And if we have sensitive performance measures, cognitive tests, why don't we have sensitive patient-reported measures that are tracking with these same constructs, the executive capabilities? What's happening from the patient's perspective or from their perspective that they can link to? You know, we heard from a construction foreman that said, you know, he was responsible for setting the schedules for the subcontractors and checking the work of the subcontractors. And suddenly he wasn't able to build a schedule anymore. Like you said, like it was hard to put a schedule together. And then he couldn't do simple math in his head. The work, you know, the quick math that he had leaned on for the, you know, the previous 40 years of his life were gone, and he couldn't check the sub's work anymore. And it was that point that he realized that he was at a risk to the job site because he couldn't check their work and he couldn't put the schedule together, and he had to come out of work, you know, much earlier than he should have, because of his inability to keep up. And so we did feel that there was a space here for converting these interviews into questions, and pulling this into a standardized assessment that could be formalized and you know, tested as a reliable, valid measure. And so we started to move in that direction, and we ended up with this PRO at the end, this patient-reported outcome.
Which is an amazing document, which I've talked about on the podcast before, and have actually just it's Jennifer, it's one of the things that when I found out that you guys had done, and then just your willingness to share it with the community was so huge. Like, I can't even tell you how much it meant that you guys are hearing these stories, and you're hearing that there's this gap. And so you were like, okay, well, let's create something. And then when we told you, like, oh, well, we don't even have anything like that, you're like, oh, well, why don't you know, use it to be able to take to your doctor? That's amazing. Which I just have to say, like, it truly blew me away. But this is that document that you were talking about.
Yes. And it's a great tool. You know, we hope this can be used as another tool for research. You know, as the community is still moving to the earlier stages of research participation. You know, a lot of these gene therapy and ASO targeting programs are trying to go earlier on in the course of the disease. It's not just, you know, us measuring cognition specifically, but as the field needs to go earlier, we need to understand these executive changes that happen earlier, and pair up sensitive objective with targeted subjective measures. And you know, and so the hope is that this can be provided back to the Huntington's research community for use in other clinical studies and natural history programs, you know, and that there's some way of moving this forward. In terms of a tool to use personally every day, it's a bit long for that, and it hasn't yet been validated in that way. But I do think that there's a way for the field to move in that direction, to provide something for people individually to track their own symptoms and experience in a way that can be informative and useful and directive. You know, you track your symptoms, you know, in a journal or you know, a diary of some sort, on the stories, you know, the things that are changing. But having a standardized tool, you know, does help to ask the same questions to the community as a whole in a research group, aggregate this information, summarize it, put a score on it, and say, you know, over time, here's what's changing, and here are the changes in the scores. Here's what the score changes mean, and be able to have conversations about changes in complex cognitive functioning and what that means for people day to day.
And I mean, it's huge for research. I 100% agree. Like, this needs to go into the research community, absolutely. But I will say, as a personal tool, for those who don't know how to describe to their doctor what they're going through, to have a document you can fill out before you go in and then say, this is what I'm dealing with, that's what's huge, right? Like, because you go into a doctor's office and they go, well, what are you experiencing? Well, the HD brain goes, I can't
Nothing.
answer the question now because I'm processing. You asked me an open-ended question, and
That
there's no way I can list everything that you could,
I
it just
could be
doesn't work.
talking about.
Right. And so having something where we could actually write down the cognitive symptoms and be like, okay, this is what I'm experiencing. It's so much easier because there's not a way really, like, we don't think about doing that, right? Like, you don't think about going into a doctor to do that.
And listing out the examples of the challenges that you've been having over the last couple of months.
Exactly,
Specific examples.
because again, that cognitive stuff has not been focused on, and so we don't realize exactly what that is, that that's such a huge part of cognitive impairment. So that's the reason that I personally like it for, for personal use, but I am with you 100% about it needing to be in HD research. And just love that you guys came up with this document.
It's it and it's really been a collaboration with the community. We worked with HDO and HDSA to identify participants, and that was how we reached out to the patient community. But then we pulled in treaters, Dr. Anderson's seen earlier versions, and some others that have done questionnaire development or research in cognition to take a look and make sure we had the words right and the response skill appropriate for research. And then we worked again together to understand the validation properties. So we developed a protocol and so a study outline of how we're going to do this research. And we wanted to give the questionnaire in context of other cognitive tests and existing Huntington's patient reported outcome measures, and to see how it was what the results look like in context of sensitive cognitive assessments. And so again, we reached out to the community. We pulled in 9 HD centers of excellence to run as clinical sites. They recruited over 150 people with Huntington's to complete the questionnaire, the cognitive test. And really, this was a long day. We had a beginning set of cognitive tests for a practice, then they did the PROs, and then they did a second set of cognitive tests. And so it was, for some people, this is like 2 hours of research that they're doing in one sitting, and cognitive testing is hard. But what we found was that we were able to understand the reliability and validity properties and how it was measuring cognitive impairment, the different concepts within cognition, different questions we're tracking with different cognitive tests. And then importantly, as this was done in the research community, we had the TFC scores for participants, so the total functioning capacity scores. And we found that as the total functioning capacity decreased, the scores on this new PRO, the Huntington's disease everyday functioning scale, the HIDEF, was decreasing in the scores. And so we could see this pattern of impairment tracking with self-reported impairment. And this really gave us strong signals to include this in the prospective program. So it's in all of our clinical studies, the two interventionals and the long-term safety. To understand from the patient's perspective what is changing over time, and if there's, an ability to measure, excuse me, responsiveness to an intervention or to progression, then we'll be able to see that in these studies. And then again, reflect that back to the community. Plan on publishing. Plan on, sharing this tool with other sponsors so they can use this in other clinical trials. And that way, we move the field forward as, as we're understanding the patient's perspective. And I think it's so important to include, you're the one with the lived experience, your perspective on things as much as we can. So I think this is really a high, a gap that we were able to, to step in and support.
Incredible. I'm just so excited about this, the whole thing. So, which I've told you before, I know. So, is there a way for people to get the document? Like, do you have a certain place they could go, or can they contact somebody in order to get the document?
So we're in the early stages of publishing the PRO and the process that we went to establish the PRO validation properties, and so this will be provided on a platform for research purposes. We'll have to do a bit of work to identify a path forward for individual use. But right now there's not an opportunity to grab the PRO for general individual use. I think that's something that as a community we can talk about how to get there, and what that looks like. And then in the meantime, being able to track patients' own functioning changes, I think is it needs to come more into the field, into the front of the field. I think we need more conversations about how can we empower people where they are to track and reflect on these changes with their physicians so that you can have the right level of conversations in that space. It's a little long, like I said, it's a little long to be used for
Sure,
day to day or for physician visit, but it is a great directive, and it does talk about these areas that that touch on the whole spectrum of your day-to-day, at home, work, driving, and socially, where these interferences are happening and just getting worse. So I think it's something that we'll have to keep working on. And I hope to have, a solution for you in the near future.
So, as far as for researchers and getting it into the research community, I mean, is that available now, or is it you, I know that you said you're going to publish, so is it they have to wait until you're published and then they can actually get it?
There is an avenue online to access through this website that has other patient-reported outcomes and clinical outcomes assessments, COAs. So broadly, there is a website that houses a lot of these clinical outcomes assessments, and it is posted there already. It can be
Okay.
downloaded from for the research community at this time. So we've already posted that, and there's scoring recommendations. And then as we publish the initial, it's called qualitative research. So this is the patient and care partner research that was done, and how we came out with the individual questions. That one is under review now, so we hope to publish that soon. And then the validation research results, those two publications, I think one is just submitted and the other one is in process. So we should be coming out with those publications in the next 6 months. And that can give more light on the tool and how it can be used, the properties to use it reliably in clinical trials, or natural history studies, and then how to interpret the scores, what the score changes mean.
Let me back up 1 second. Can you explain what a natural history study is for people so they know what that is?
Yes, yeah. And a really valuable tool in the Huntington's space. A natural history study is a study that aims to understand what the experience is for, we'll use Huntington's as the example, for someone with Huntington's as the condition evolves, as it progresses. And so starting as early as the diagnosis timeframe, capturing the symptoms and the clinical picture. Sometimes there are neuroimaging and biomarkers included in that. But then on, following up and continuing to bring the same group of people back in to understand what's happened next, what's happened next. The best example of a natural history study in Huntington's is the Enroll HD program. And this is, I think, Enroll just hit its 10-year anniversary this past year. It's been a tremendous source of data for clinical researchers, those in drug development, as we understand the biomarkers, the neuroimaging that's progressing, that's contributing to progression, and then the symptoms and patient experience as well. And depending on the clinical program, you can target where you're doing your research in that space where things are changing, or you can understand the potential for an intervention and what this could help with for people. So a natural history study aims to follow people as long as possible. And so Enroll has really up to 10 years of data on people who have Huntington's, people from the earliest stages, pre-diagnosis, partners that don't have Huntington's, and so understanding what not Huntington's looks like as well. And all of this comes together to form this rich data set so that the community can access to build the right studies and target the right stages of Huntington's for an intervention. So it's a really valuable tool in the research space. And then in terms of patient-reported outcomes, Enroll has a couple, but this is where we saw a bit of a gap in what was changing in the early stages and how we could plug in.
And talking about natural history studies and the importance, this is one of the reasons, guys, like I push research so much, especially participating, even if you can't participate in a clinical trial, see, about participating in an observational study like Enroll HD, or Prevent HD, things like that. The reason is it also helps speed up the whole clinical trial process, right? Because now these companies that are doing these clinical trials can use these natural history studies, and it's not, we're not having to wait so many years to see the change in one patient. So again, this is why that's huge. The natural history studies really make a huge difference in research, and really move things forward at a faster pace.
It really does. It really helps us know what the experience is, what's next, how long does it take to get there? And this helps inform what measures we would use in our studies, how long our studies need to be, what other kinds of measures would we be missing, and really sets up the even identifying stages of Huntington's came from Enroll HD. The HD integrated staging system came from Enroll HD. It was informed by Enroll. And so these are all additional tools that help us understand, identify, diagnose, target, different stages of Huntington's, all so we can work towards the same.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this information, talking with me. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on, Lauren, and thank you for all that you're doing to bring light to this conversation, to bring awareness about the challenges and unmet needs in treating cognition, and for inviting us to share more about the research we've been doing at Sage. Like I said, this is a favorite area of mine, so I'm really happy to pop in and share what we're doing.
Anytime, you're welcome anytime. I could probably talk about that too for hours and hours. So,
Thank you.
for those listening, thanks so much for tuning in. I hope that you are getting a lot out of this research side and the fact that we're moving towards this focus on this earlier part of HD and finally getting things seen and reported. And I think that's huge because it's really going to help us not only when it comes to research and being able to get into clinical trials and observational studies, but also when it comes to resources, being able to go to a neurologist and,
Yes.
actually get resources instead of being told, well, there's no reason for you to be here because you don't have movements. So it's huge.
To say
So,
this is part of Huntington's.
So definitely take advantage of the resources available. And, I hope that you are finding these shows useful as we start talking more and more about this newer research and the new things coming out. And we're certainly excited. I know that I'm certainly excited about everything up and coming, continuing right now. It's all just super exciting to see everything moving in this direction. And the fact that it's moving faster, I think for me, that's another really exciting part. So thank you for listening today. Make sure that you are tuning in every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern time for a new show. If you'd like to be part of our HD Uncut series, which is for the HD community to come on and share whatever you want to share, uncut, uncensored, please contact me. If you are a young investigator and you would like to come on and share the stuff that you are doing in HD research, please contact me. I'd love to have you on. I love those shows and could probably talk for hours about research. So my email is lauren@help4hd.org. That's LAUREN at HELP, the number 4hd.org. Okay, until next time, guys, take care and love you.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit www.help4hd.org and sign up for our email newsletter to stay up to date on all that is going on at Help 4HD. Get social with us and like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to Help 4HD TV on YouTube, and ring the bell for notifications.